Okay, yeah, so the, I'll rephrase my question about the, your F1 engine program and how you had to report progress difficulties or whatever up through the Saturn program office or higher.
Right, well, initially, at my level, I would have meetings with a contractor, usually on about a monthly basis. And in those meetings, we would go out to the contractor for a monthly review of where the project stood, what were the problems, what they were doing to understand the problem, what were they doing to fix the problem, and what was the impact on schedules and cost at that time. So we did that at the project level. Now, periodically, we would have reviews of the whole S1C stage status, and we were invited to participate in those and to make presentations at those reviews to Arthur Rudolph at that level. In those meetings, I believe most of the time they even invited Von Braun to attend, and he would attend quite a number of them. Some of them he didn't, but he would attend as many as he could.
Okay.
Committed. Mm-hmm. So he was getting an up-to-date picture of what was happening on that interface and the engine problems we were having versus the S1C problems, etc. So it was like a monthly review that was being held at the project level and at least a quarterly review at the stage level.
Okay. How did the...
And it did involve a level higher than Arthur Rudolph.
Mm-hmm.
It would go to the Von Braun level.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe to me how the work, since the S1C was also developed at Marshall,
mm-hmm.
how your office worked with the S1C office in terms of the interface between the engine and the stage?
Well, the thing that we had to do, and one of our laboratories was responsible for this, was to develop an interface document, a document that defined not only the mechanical interface,
mm-hmm.
but what the fluid interfaces should be, what the thermal interface was. They defined a set of documentation that it was we had a responsibility to meet our end of it, and the stage had a responsibility to meet their end of it.
Okay.
And that was a controlled set of documents that once they were frozen and agreed to, they could not be changed without a formal change procedure.
Mm-hmm.
We had to initiate a formal change document. It had to be approved by both sides. It had to be approved by the by Rocketdyne if they were involved, or Boeing when they were involved in the S1C. And if it cost them a change in their hardware, then you got a change proposal from the contractor, and you negotiated that in terms of cost and fee. And what the new technical requirement was.
Mm-hmm. I imagine...
It was a very formal process.
Okay. You mentioned during the LRV program you were able to limit these change orders. Were the...
Part of that was the experience that I had with this program.
Okay.
And yes. And what we did, and I thought it was a very innovative approach that we took, although it did receive a lot of criticism by very top management at NASA headquarters because they were embarrassed with an overrun. They didn't want to call it an overrun.
Okay.
But the thing that we found out is that every time a contractor had a problem, it didn't have to necessarily be an interface problem, but a problem with the turbo machinery,
mm-hmm.
where they had to change an alloy maybe, or they had to change the design of the turbine wheel. Every time he had to make that change, he would come back to the government for approval to make the change. And he would send you a bill for making that change. It was a cost plus fixed fee contract.
I'm glad you brought this up because I want to get into that.
Cost plus fixed fee.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way all the contracts were at that time. Okay? Well, what I found out was that I was spending not only most of my time in negotiations, because there was just change after change that had to be made. Some of them were minor, some of them were major,
mm-hmm.
okay? And I was spending all my time in negotiations with Rocketdyne, tying up not only their technical people to justify the change, but our technical people to agree with the change, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And our technical people to help evaluate how much this really should cost the government. I mean, is their cost estimate realistic
mm-hmm.
or not?
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself engaged in that probably 80% of my time during the real heart of the program was in a negotiation of some
really?
Time. It was an enormous amount of time. So when I did get when I got the LRP program, I said, you know, the real weakness in this whole contract business is that we're holding the contractor's hand so tightly that he can't maneuver unless we give him a change order. So I want to tell him what the requirement is in terms of what this vehicle's got to do, and let him decide what he's got to do to make it work that way.
Okay?
Now, if he's got to come back and say, I can't work that, I've got to change the whole interface, now we'll talk about a change. But if whatever he's got to do to make this thing work so that the vehicle could go into a crater that's a foot and a half deep,
mm-hmm.
so that it can go over a block that's 1 foot high, he has to make that design change to make it do that. I'll just tell him it's got to go over the 1 foot
right.
block, and it's got to be able to go into a 2 foot diameter crater.
Right.
Okay, so we took a performance approach on the LRV based on my experience with the F1, which was a set of documents that said, hey, this is the best of what we think this engine's going to look like. Any changes we make to it, you know, we'll come back to the government, we'll tell you how much it's going to cost to change.
So it never, the F1 engine program, and it seems like there were always contracts going on, either being renewed or being modified.
Right.
It never transitioned to an incentive fee approach.
No, it did. That was my next big problem.
Because development contracts are one thing, production contracts are another, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Somewhere in about the period of time of 1964-65, someone got the bright idea, again, as a result of experience with other programs, that said, you know, we ought to incentivize these contractors to do a better job. And if they can control costs, we ought to give them a special reward. If they can beat the schedule, we ought to give them a reward. If they technically give you a better item, they ought to have a reward.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, if they overran, we ought to hit them with a fee adjustment. If they didn't meet the technical requirements and we had to give them relief, we ought to hit them with a fee hit. And so we were told, let's go ahead and change all these contracts to cost plus incentive fee. So we went from a cost plus fixed fee to a cost plus incentive fee. And the F1 engine, all those big contracts we had, including the production, all had to be incentivized now.
How did you control cost? The cost could be whatever it cost them to do it, or was the cost a fixed dollar value plus an incentive fee? I want to understand that structure. You understand
what I'm saying? The cost was always proposed as an estimated cost to do this particular change.
Okay.
And you negotiated a fee based on that cost. And the cost plus fixed fee, that fee stuck on that particular change. And the cost plus incentive fee, there was a variation there that if he was able to bring in the item below cost, he'd get a little bit more fee.
Okay. It was like a carrot and stick.
Yes.
I mean, there was an incentive for them to both control costs and
meet the technical requirements. Yeah.
Okay. So the F1 engine program did transition to that type of contract.
And that was still when I was still the project manager, that happened.
Okay.
Yeah. And then we had the added problem that our negotiation with Rocketdyne, I hate to say it was tougher, but it was tougher than what the J2 also had to undergo at that same period of time. They had to be incentivized.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had two project managers that were busy negotiating with Rocketdyne for the individual programs, and we went our own way to a certain degree. We diverged. And what I was seeing was I was getting it in my negotiation with Rocketdyne, hey, they're not doing it that way over in the J2.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we do it the way the J2 guys are doing it,
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't want to back off of it. And I forget what the issues were at the time, but we had some good cogent reasons why we wanted to do it the way we did it. And it finally had to be resolved by taking it to Leland Ballou that
mm-hmm.
we were going two different ways on this thing. And it was an issue that was of significant substance. It wasn't just I prefer to do something like this. It was substantial.
Mm-hmm.
and Leland listened to both sides of the argument, and he agreed that the F1 approach ought to be the approach we take on both programs. So Bud Drummond had to go back and hammer out a slightly different agreement.
Did this cost-plus incentive fee contract come from NASA headquarters? Did it originate from NASA headquarters then?
The requirement to go incentive fee came from NASA headquarters. Okay. All the contracts at Marshall had to be incentivized at that point. Mm-hmm. So we all went cost plus incentive fee.
Okay.
Now they have since evolved into a better deal than that because they found out that the incentive arrangement was so rigid that it didn't allow for interpretation sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And the contract even came out with a windfall or maybe was substantially penalized for something that he really produced something that was a good product and should have been rewarded for. So in subsequent years it became cost plus award fee.
Oh, okay.
And the award, you had an award board that met then and said, well, how did he really do on this? And,
mm-hmm.
You know, and then based on how he did, there was a subjective decision made as to how much fee he ought to get.
Okay.
Whereas in the incentive arrangement we had, the fee was predetermined ahead of time. If you hit this milepost, you got this fee. If you didn't hit it, you got that fee, you know. It
okay.
was all lined out, so there was no subjectiveness afterwards.
Okay. All right.
If I had to do the LRV all over again, I would have done it with an award fee.
Okay.
Because I think Boeing, in the long run, did such a marvelous job getting those three vehicles to work that I would like to have given them a 10% fee instead of the 1% that they got.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That's hindsight.
Okay, yes.
But it was still the best deal going at the time. I didn't have to spend any time negotiating. I spent all my time worrying about the technical aspects of the program.
Yes.
And I didn't have to spend it in a negotiating room.
Mm-hmm. The F1 engine program was really a rather long program, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
And when you look at
7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank Stewart worked at another, I think about 7 years after I left.
Let me try to pinpoint then, when did you get your first opportunity to see a full duration test? Mid-60, around 65 or?
It would have been somewhere in there, probably 64.
It would have been at Marshall? Or did you go out
No, it would have been at Edwards Air Force.
Really? Okay.
The responsibility for the development of the engine was Rocketdyne's,
mm-hmm.
and that was their facility out there that we built for them.
Okay.
Corps of Engineers built for them.
Okay, because that's another aspect I want to understand. Who was responsible for building these stands for the F1? You say there were three of them?
There were three production stands, and there was one single-position R&D stand,
mm-hmm.
and one dual-position, I believe, R&D stand that we built for them.
Meaning it was vertical or horizontal? Dual position, or there two locations.
Two locations.
I see. Yeah.
It was test stand 1A and 1B.
Yeah. Okay.
We were responsible for creating the requirement as to what was needed for the program. We turned over the job of actually seeing to it that they were built properly to the Corps of Engineers.
Okay.
So we turned over money and that responsibility to the Corps of Engineers. We just monitored it at that point.
Okay, so the driver for the design, the configuration of these test stands really came from
Rocketdyne and the Corps of Engineers.
Okay. What was your personal experience witnessing the first? Because I always ask people this. I want to get their reaction of what it was first. And how far were you from the test stand, type of thing? You remember? Were you anxious? Were you nervous? Or obviously there had been previous firings, so I mean for them it was no
very
big
anxious.
Deal. But for you,
very anxious.
Uh-huh.
And it was an awesome display of power. And I don't mean political power. I mean just raw power.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome, awesome display. A cacophony of sound like
yeah.
you could not believe. You know,
yeah.
and vibration that you could feel through the earth.
Mm-hmm.
It was just awesome.
Mm-hmm. One of the fascinating things about the F1 is that this monstrous engine with all this power could actually gimbal. And one of the most fascinating parts or sub-assemblies of this engine is that gimbal.
That's right.
Because that was the interface between the engine itself and
the vehicle structure.
The thrust structure, its mating part there. A lot of people, or what I hope to educate them is that they don't know how these engines were actually mounted to the Saturn V, the thrust structure. And I'm going to illustrate in the book what these were, and I just recently come across some fantastic photographs about those mating portions. Yeah. I think I read somewhere there was actually Teflon. There was some sort of
because it.
Maybe you can help me understand another aspect mechanically of the engine. It had these triangular struts on the outside around the turbo pump that had, I guess, servo actuators to these large portions on the S1C stage. I'm trying to understand the mechanical aspect of how they connected to the stage and what their function was. They had the big conical forms to protect the engine, but there were also mechanical struts inside there that I think tied somehow with...
To the actuator. The actuator had to have a rigid point to attach to the vehicle.
Okay.
And another point on the engine, and then it would expand inside and cause that engine to move one way or the other.
Okay.
So it served the typical function of any actuator or a shock absorber. And the car would serve the same function, basically. Mm-hmm. So it had two rigid points, one on the vehicle, one on the engine. Well, once it expanded, it would drive the engine over.
Yes.
Okay, and of course you had them in two planes on the engine, and that gave you the capability to put the engine in any position you wanted for control and steering capability of the vehicle.
Okay. And that control is a fascinating thing, because the four outboard engines were all gimbal, could gimbal,
right.
And the center engine was fixed. One question I want to ask you, was there a separate development, maybe not, but was there a separate development program for the fixed engine and one for the gimbaled engine?
No.
Okay. There was simply testing involved to make sure that they were performing the way, but there wasn't a separate, there weren't parallel programs, it was not necessary.
Programs, no.
Yeah.
It was the same engine.
Okay. In the development of the F1 from the Marshall side, did things arise that caused, that resulted in unexpected changes to the engine or the interface between the engine and the thrust structure? Or was it a logical sequence where there were no major surprises or hiccups in that respect? Because during development, I'm trying to figure out, well, something would arise that would cause a resulting change?
I think the only thing that changed, and it had nothing to do with the internal guts of the engine itself, but it was with those four fixed engines, they had to be so close together that you had a little diamond pattern that was open between those engines.
Yes.
That could again allow gases to come up and come,
yeah,
right into the bottom of the tanks. So that had to be, there had to be a closure down there, and still you had to be able to get past the closure to service the engine when it was on the pad.
I see.
So it was a removable closure that we had up there, and that was, as I remember, the closure itself was the responsibility of the stage guys.
Okay.
But it was a tricky interface to make sure that it sealed that cavity between those four engines.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it was strong enough that you could put a human being up through it to service the engine. And so that was some tricky things in there. But
okay. Did you have any need to have to go down to the Cape in relation to this program did you interface with Dr. Debus or anything like that?
I've given him a couple of presentations, but other than that, no.
Okay.
But his people were always invited to all of our meetings.
Mm-hmm.
Again, from an interface point of view, they needed to know what to expect when the engines got down there, because they had to have the capability of installing engines and removing engines, so they had to be familiar with the equipment that was being used to to maneuver those engines in position.
How about Michoud? Did you have to go to Michoud and work with, or have your people go to Michoud to,
yeah,
to work?
Yeah, but again, it was in the context of engine handling equipment. How do you handle the engine and install it into the vehicle?
Okay.
Or take it out if you needed to.
Okay. Other than the test firing that you witnessed, were there any particular moments that there were memorable for you of any kind with respect to the F-1 program?
Well, when we fired it here in Huntsville, all four of them.
Yeah.
Excuse me, all five.
You mean, yeah, the S-1C stage?
The S-1C stage, yeah. That was extremely memorable. Mm-hmm. So I had never seen anything like that before in my life or since.
The target thrust for this was 1.5 million pounds, but it had to be uprated when later in the Apollo program they wanted to take, they had to upgrade the lunar module with greater capacity for fuel and consumables, as well as the lunar rover. So were you involved in the uprating program, or did that go to France?
Initial uprating, yes, I was involved in it, but that was the time when I moved over to head up another program.
Okay.
And what? Frank Stewart took over that period of time, and he would be the best to talk more accurately about that time.
Okay. When I was out at the archives today, Leland Ballou had donated a J-2 and an
H-1. But there was no F-1 there.
No F-1.
Yeah.
I'm going, oh no, where's the F-1? Somebody has that F-1.
It's out at Marshall Space Flight Center in their little archive.
Oh, is that right?
Museum, yeah. As you walk in the main building.
Oh, is that right? I'll see it tomorrow. Okay.
And I think there's also one out at the Space and Rocket Center.
There is, okay.
I think so.
Because those models are just, the detail's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I did a great job on that.
Very impressive, yeah.
Yeah, we had the H-1, the F-1, the RL-10 was modeled, and I think we even had one on the C-1 engine, which was a tiny engine.
Yeah. I'm trying to think now. Let me review my questions here. I've hit all the key points here.
Would you care for something to drink?
Oh, that'd be great. Let me shut this off. What I wanted to discuss too, although I'll review the other questions here. Were you in terms of uprating is one thing, but the F-1A, what can you tell me about the F-1A program? Did that follow on much later under Frank's stewardship?
I don't know what the F-1A is. It's not ringing a bell at all.
Okay. Well, believe it or not, there were actually papers written about this thing. Then it must have come
was
in.
Was it the uprated engine, did they call it?
Well, no. Actually, what it was, but I'm asking because you were the original manager, that they were thinking of bringing back the F-1 engine with certain improvements.
For the shuttle?
I think
for this Ares program?
Possible. No, not so much the Ares, but for a maintaining that kind of technology, that level of power. But basically it was supplanted by solid rocket motor technology, I think. The solid rocket motors basically. NASA has made a shift from, in terms of high thrust, I guess they've really taken a liking to the solid rocket motor approach to...
Well, that's high thrust also.
It is. Because they're going to use the J-2S, a cluster of five of those for the Ares 5, the main tank, and with two solid rocket motors. Of course, you're familiar with that.
No, I'm not, as a matter of fact.
So the Ares 5 will be as tall as the Saturn. Basically, it will be a cargo launch vehicle for translunar injection of the command module, the service module, and anything else they want to send on its way. But that's a long way away, I think. They want to develop the Ares 1 first, both the capsule and the launch vehicle, and it's because they just don't have the budget to do it all like they did in the 60s.
Yeah, and I don't know, I'm not sure they're going to get the money from Congress.
It's not looking good. It's just like they let a little bit out, a little bit out. It's just like NASA.
They're going to wait until the Chinese do something spectacular, and then everyone will say, how
could
this happen to us?
Yeah, right.
How could this happen to us?
Well, maybe that's what it'll take, you know.
It's terrible being a reactive society, though, you know?
It is. We should be in America. This is America. It should be innovative, not reactive.
Yeah, we should be proactive in science and the engineering field as
well. Well, when did you, what year then did you finish your F1 program management?
1967, I went off the program.
Okay.
And I had a short period of time where I was elevated to being the deputy program manager of the office. At that time, Lou and Ballou had moved over to the Skylab.
Yes.
And Bill Brown took over the management of the program office, and I became Bill Brown's deputy. So I had an overview of all of the projects, okay, but I was no longer the project manager of the F1. And I stayed in that capacity for about a year, I remember. And then along came Bud Drummond, who was the J2 manager, moved over and joined Lou and Ballou on the Skylab. And so they were at a loss for who was going to fill in and take over the J2 for that time. And it turned out that there was a double failure with the J2 on one of the Saturn V launches.
Yes, that's right. I remember that.
So Ron Brown got a hold of me when I was, matter of fact, I think I was in Montreal. Expo 67, that's what it was.
Okay.
I was at Expo 67 in Montreal, and I get a call from the office saying, Ron Brown would like for you to come back and also assume the responsibility for the J2.
Okay.
So I spent 2.5 years working the problem through on the J2 to get it man-rated again.
That was not, and that was a manned flight when that happened, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Not a
but
good
we
thing.
Had, no, fortunately they weren't failures that were catastrophic in nature.
Right.
They shut one engine off early.
Was it a faulty sensor thing? One of them was a fault.
It was an ASI line, auxiliary spark ignition line, that had a vibration and cracked it. And so they were getting liquid hydrogen and oxygen spewing out into the boat tail at high altitude. It didn't do any damage.
Mm-hmm.
If it was in the lower atmosphere where there was more oxygen available, we might have had a big fire or something.
Yes.
But this just resulted in a sensor picking that up and saying, okay, shut the engine down. Well, it was all miswired somehow and shut the wrong engine down.
Oh, okay.
So they shut one of the J2 engines off, and it was the wrong one, and then I think they had to shut the right one off, or it shut itself off. And then that same engine had to perform the S4B stage. It had two functions. It had to first put the vehicle into Earth orbit, and then it was going to be a translunar injection engine, so it had
very
to restart.
Very important.
It
has
to restart,
and
it did not restart.
Oh, yes, that's right.
So it was the same engine, double failure.
Bad day.
And Ron Brown wanted somebody on it that he could depend on. And the only alternative was to get the old project manager back off of the Skylab. And that wasn't, I guess, that didn't seem to be a logical solution to Von Braun. I guess he figured, well, the first one was running it when this thing happened. You know, why should I put it back on the program?
Okay.
That's just conjecture on my part.
Okay.
So,
well, what's interesting is you had a very large collection of lunar rover material you donated to the archives, but the rover program was only about 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
You were on the F1 engine program for years, but I didn't find a lot of stuff there. I was just kind of disappointed today. You didn't bring. You don't have anything here at home in terms of photographs or anything at all like
that.
Yeah,
I do have a little bit of that. Let me see what I.
Okay.